Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is James Galvin, Jim Galvin, the author most recently of a novel called Fencing the Sky, published by Henry Holt. I first heard Jim Galvin's name when I was at a writing conference in Yellow Bay, Montana. You know, sometimes there's a special frequency a voice goes into when it's saying something that it believes and is important. And Bill Kittredge, whom I like a lot, a Western American writer and essayist, said to me, you know what the best book on the American West is? It's a book called The Meadow. It's a book-length essay, meditation, prose poem about a meadow. And it's absolutely unforgettable. So I always take people's advice about things like that, at least. And I went off and got the book. And sure enough, it's one of the amazing American books. And it's available from Owl Books in paperback. But this is Galvin's first novel. He's written four books of poetry, and his collected poems are published by Copper Canyon Press. The opening line of a recent poem in a sequence called Stations, describes something like fencing the sky. It says, between a bird's nest and a solar system. And there is something, a kind of combination handmade and vast geometric unfathomability to the structure of this book. And I wondered if we could talk about that a little bit. How did you put it together?
Yeah, I think that line, that's a very astute association, one that I might not have made myself in terms of the form of the novel, but now that you mention it, it seems apt. I didn't want to, I probably wouldn't be temperamentally capable of writing a conventional cause and effect type of book because I don't experience the passage of time that way. Maybe that's why I've written more poetry than prose. And the prose that I've written is not ever structured in a way that most people recognize as having seen before. There's William Butler Yeats has a book called The Vision, which it's a little bit flaky, and it doesn't really make sense. But he does have a diagram for what he considers to be the dynamic of history. And what it is two spirals intersecting each other. He calls them gyres. One representing chaos and one representing order. And so I wanted to try to write something that was modeled on that formal idea so that this book starts with anecdotal and seemingly unrelated events which gradually spiral into an ordered narrative, but as the form becomes more ordered, the events become more out of control. Things go out of control in this novel. A person gets killed, and you know, there's a chase, and people's lives fly apart. So, and then having done something along that line, I wanted to turn that whole model inside out and make it even more concentric again and more spirally. And so just sort of by reaching into the inside of it and pulling it inside out partly, I was able to get it to not begin at the beginning or the end, but to begin at the beginning of the end and not to end at the beginning or the end, but to end at the end of the beginning, which pleased me, maybe in a perverse way, but that's a poet for you.
Well, you know, listeners who may have heard other interviews with Jim Galvin will be surprised because most of the time the typical interview with Jim Galvin includes a recording of the Rawhide theme and mentions of the Marlboro Man, and he carefully explains that the Marlboro Man was not invented by the Reynolds Company, was in fact a horse trainer who managed to save his farm, in fact, his ranch, by the funds he got for those advertisements. But a lot of people want to believe that because you were raised in the West and know as much as certainly any writer knows about horses, that these literary ways of organizing a book will not be yours, that,
right.
that this is going to be simply prose as big as the outdoors with a lot of chasing on horses going along. What does that do to you as a writer?
Well, it's annoying. I think that one of the problems that Westerners face is that, shall I say, we are considered an illiterate culture. And if we're at all literate, especially I've had this experience in regard to poetry, people hear that I'm from the West and that I write poetry, and they immediately get an image of someone rather like Baxter Black, someone who writes, you know, funny poems about veterinary disasters in rhyme, in rhyme and meter. And I don't see it that Western fiction is not necessarily characterized by those kinds of approaches, and there are writers who have written about the West in more dignified ways.
The great American poet Charles Olson pointed out that really the history of the American novel is a history of writers learning to describe how people work. He says the essential American novel is Moby Dick, which has descriptions of the harpoons, of the ropes, even of the libraries in which books about whales are on the shelves. And your book seems to contain both of them, the values of knowing and respecting one's tools, human, animal, otherwise. How do you convey what is the language of how to do things?
I think knowing something about how to do it, having witnessed it, is essential, and then willing to dignify it in its particularity is also essential. I really think that in America today, part of what's distressing is the degree to which people want to get out of work. They want to avoid work, labor-saving devices, you know. And I think work is good, and I think that work is especially good if it's traditional work. If you're working with horses, for example, you're involved with a tradition that's 6,000 years old, more or less, and it involves deep knowledge. It's not like selling things. Maybe there's an art to that too, but it's not fun to describe. So in the same way that I think that Melville was probably, a lot of his motivation was probably that he just thought that whaling was great and that the knowledge and the traditions and the amount of courage and concentration and action in response to circumstance, he just was joying in that. And I don't see any reason not to joy in work that can be allegorized or possibly just made into something that's not drudgery, but something that's a tradition that has value beyond just getting something done.
Eventually, and I'm going to follow up on your use of the words allegorized, eventually the very landscape of this book becomes like a death and rebirth canal. The hero of the book, Mike, is going to, he's murdered a man, and he's performing a series of first sort of desperate, but then ritualized and historical gestures. We're seeing that he's both putting his life in disorder and putting his life in order. It's the order of the telling and the order of the doing, and eventually he's going to disappear through a spout, much the way Ishmael does in Moby Dick. Did I do that right?
Tashtego.
Is it Tashtego?
Ishmael saves. I'm not. But Squeakquig saves Tashtego, who falls into the whale, Queequeg swims underneath and delivers him, as it were, from the whale. So, yes, I was thinking about that.
And so the landscape eventually becomes like giving birth to a calf, which happens in this book, and the man is going to be reborn at the end of the book, anonymous. This is a kind of pilgrim's progress in reverse. Yeah. A reborning process. How do you make a landscape function both actually as well as figuratively?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure I have a handy answer to it. My inclination is to just say that if that dynamic is true in the world, you can trust the landscape to provide it, just by paying attention to it.
So you feel that this allegory of the land is actually there, that the land provides meaning to us?
Absolutely. I think that it's church.
Uh-huh. The land is the church.
Yeah.
And then would you say that a decline of meaning is a result of moving away from the land, or a lack of orientation to the land?
I think that the danger is losing touch with the conversation that we call agriculture, that we've been carrying on for a long time now. And increasingly you see the incorporation or industrialization of those traditional kinds of work. And that indeed does deprive us of the thread of the conversation with the land. And without that, I'm not sure what good we are.
I'm talking to Jim Galvin about his novel Fencing the Sky. Does that mean then that as a poet and writer, partially you're reporting on the land as a natural thing, but also reminding people of a lost relation?
Yeah, I think so. Work lets the land be the land from a human point of view. And yes, I don't know about lost, but losing. And everything is at stake here. It's our own future, the quality of the lives of our children, the air we're going to be breathing, what we're going to be looking at, the stories that we tell ourselves, how we think about ourselves. So I think that what we're talking about is telling ourselves a different kind of story about our relationship to the world, one that's not about going forth and conquering and bringing back, one that's not about getting and spending, one that's not about conquest, one that's about, the progress from judgment towards compassion rather than the progress of making things bigger.
Now, I know that The Meadow is considered to be a memoir, and what you've told me about a memoir, and even about fiction, is that it should contain truth, or that it should not contain things that are untrue. Now, what do you mean by truth in this particular context?
That's a very, almost a nasty question.
Oh, I don't mean that. Me?
Well, of course, getting back to Melville, he knows what the truth is. He knows it's something that you have to see in many different ways, and that there isn't just one. There isn't the truth of Rousseau, and there isn't the truth of Calvin, and there isn't the truth of science, and there isn't the truth of law. But those are all ways of viewing something that's out there that is true. I think you just do your best to tell it. And there's some kind of a radar that we have, both in telling it and in hearing it. It's a tuning fork that we have, I hope, to know when something is true in the way that great art is true. It's not true by being rational or provable, or maybe not by being accurate in some scientific sense. It's just true to how we feel and true to how things are for us.
So is this a kind of, the version that we know best of this in Western culture is Platonic, that there is a higher truth toward which things on earth aspire, that what we live around, among, inside of is not truth. It is factual, but it is not revealed or truthful. Is that the kind of thing you're suggesting?
I wouldn't go so far as to say platonic, at least not in terms of my prose. If we were talking about poetry, I'd have to rethink that this answer entirely. Uh-huh. But I think that the idea of aspiring toward, you know, an asymptotic kind of approach to something which is more true.
Okay, I'm going to define asymptotic.
Okay.
Just to show that I know what it means. As a line that approaches another but never exactly reaches it before it declines away. So, in other words, we're approaching or aspiring toward truth but not being able to touch it.
Exactly. I don't think that it's, in a Platonic sense, achievable or touchable, at least not in my experience. It's not. But I think getting very, 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 very close is good. And it's not only good in terms of what's true in terms of our experience and our emotions and what we suffer, but it's also a good line to draw in terms of trying to make oneself a more dignified being, trying to make oneself better, trying to make oneself more empathetic and conscious and less ignorant, especially of other people, other species, of things that aren't us. And I think that you can really work on that by telling yourself stories, myths and legends even, to encourage that. In this book, for example, the character Oscar looks to his father, to his grandfather, to a neighbor, an old-timer, who are actual embodiments of a more ideal kind of behavior. In the meadow, the character Lyle has a very right relationship with the earth that he, the unearthly landscape that he inhabits. And characters like that, people like that, encourage all of us to try to get closer to that line. And without their examples, we're really base.
Now, Lyle is the character who inspires the meadow and inspires the writer of the meadow, and he reappears in your new book, Fencing the Sky. But I want to ask you, because most of us have never had a Lyle in our lives, what was it like to know someone of that sagacity and at the same time indifference to being liked?
Yeah. Well, I was blessed. This is a man I knew all my life. He was my mentor. If I know anything worth knowing, I probably learned it from him. But, of course, as a small child, one thinks that everything is normal. And so I didn't see anything special about the way he was until I got a little older and saw some other ways of being to compare it to, at which point I realized that this man was a genius, not only in an intellectual sense, but in a spiritual sense, and that he was a person to be emulated. No one's ever going to hit that line, but it's a good thing to try to get close to. One of the things that was bad about knowing Lyle is how frustrating it is to never get anything that right.
Now, you became a writer, though, and what was he a model for that as well? Because he seems to, in a sense, to be shaping someone who would not necessarily become a writer.
In that culture, the one that I grew up in out there, you know, after World War II.
Where is it?
Northern Colorado and southern Wyoming. A male child would never be encouraged to do anything sensitive. Nobody's going to ask you to write a poem. They might now, but when I was growing up, they wouldn't. But Lyle had a kind of, he paid attention to things in a way that seems to me now, talking about it, that's the way that you have to pay attention to things to write. You have to pay attention till it hurts. And so he was literary to a certain. He only had an eighth grade education, but that didn't keep him from reading everything, you know, from Homer to contemporary poetry. And he loved stories. There were a lot of things he didn't like too. For example, William Faulkner.
Your favorite.
Yes. And he would say, if that son of a bitch wants to tell me a story, why don't he just start at the beginning and tell it? You know, that was Lyle. And so in many ways, you know, he didn't teach me how to write. But the kind of attentiveness that he taught me, certainly, I would hope, has found its way into my books.
Now, from the time of The Meadow, where Lyle represents a kind of huge fathering presence, now we've got Fencing the Sky, and that presence has become an entirely different presence. The presence in the novel is of another person who is said to have the force of weather, and that is the real estate man, Meriwether Snipes, whose face is chronically red and who rams at cows because he just doesn't like them. And he seems to, in fact, have developed another kind of flock. He's got a lot of people coming in who feel that they deserve, you know, the classic 40 acres and a mule, except they don't want the mule. Right. They want to sit in the 40 acres and
40 acres in a lawn chair.
Yeah. now, do they not deserve the 40 acres? And how do we feel about those people? And are they not deserving of the compassion and attention that one pays in the Lyle world?
That's a great question. First of all, there's a difference, at least in this book, there's a difference between the guy who's peddling the land and making a ton of money off of it and the people who are buying it. Indeed, all they want is a little piece of heaven, which is all anybody ever wanted. There's a lot of innocence in the characters in this book, including in that real estate agent. His innocence takes the form of acquisitiveness. But the innocence of the people who become his prey takes the form of wanting to be free of what's making them miserable in their lives, and they think that if they can buy 40 acres with a nice view, that will bring them solace. What they don't realize, because they're innocent, is that when they come in droves, it obliterates the thing that they came for, which does not mean that the thing that they came for is undignified. It just means that it's unattainable in that particular way.
A kind of endless Heisenberg principle.
Absolutely.
To see the thing that you want to see unspoiled, you have to go there and spoil it.
That's it.
Multiplied by 400. Huh?
Exactly.
Do you think by the end of this book, the hero has become anonymous? People, in fact, think he's dead. He's gone through a night sea journey. He's gone through an underground lake and come out the other side where no one sees him. He's not going to be prosecuted for a potentially accidental murder. And we know as we read this book that the likelihood of this is very, very small, that now the book is in a special realm of sort of heroic gesture and a certain amount of wish fulfillment. What he seems to want to go off to do now is what he yearned to do years before as a radical. He says to someone sitting next to him on a bus that he's going to blow up the Liberty Bell. Now, is the other side of being processed through this life the creation and abetting of chaos?
Yeah.
Yeah?
I think that It is a kind of a Blakean dynamic of oppression and revolution and frustration. And I think a lot of what that character is doing is showing the different facets of idealism. He starts out, for my generation, the defining historical event is the war in Vietnam. And everyone my age had to either be against it or in it, pretty much. And so he was against it. And his idealism was involved with that quote-unquote revolution, which involved also Marxism and other things like that, very idealistic notions. Those notions being thwarted by the law, he does go to jail for a while, and he comes out, and transmogrifies that idealism into wanting to be a cowboy, which he perceives in his innocence as being a life where all you have to do is work hard and you won't hurt anybody and you'll be out there in the land, and there's a lot of innocence in that. But he is willing to do the work.
Did you share that innocence? Is that your innocence? Clearly not now, but at one time.
I don't think it's been possible to think that way since 1970 or even before. And so he finds out, I think, that there's no solace in it, and he's willing to do the work. But when that idealism is taken from him, he loses his wife, his way of life. He has to run. That idealism goes through that funnel and comes out in a potentially more horrifying form, that of the terrorist. And I guess it's possible, I think, for idealism to be frustrated to the point where it becomes terrorism. And I think we ought to think about that.
Now, on the other hand, idealism can be reshaped to become a certain kind of writing, which is, I think, what has happened in your case.
Yes, I think that you can take your frustration and your grief, as people have, as far as we know, always done, and turn it into what we recognize as art. And in so doing, you might avoid becoming a terrorist. You might avoid destroying yourself in any number of ways. You might be able to make something out of loss. That's what the elegy is, and my work tends to be elegiac. It's to take a sense of loss and lack and grief, and by appealing to universal principles, find something good about it. If it works, one of the things that you're going to find in it is a connection to the history of human emotions, which will bring us closer together, which will allow us to treat each other properly, and which will bring us a higher degree of respect for the world, and an ability to walk more lightly on it.
I've been speaking to James Galvin, the author of Fencing the Sky, a novel published by Henry Holt. Thank you very much for joining me, Jim.
It was sure my pleasure, Michael. Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. Special production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book, off the mouse, pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.